Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkar. And more importantly, today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Meenal Srivastava, who is professor in the Department of Political Economy and Global Studies at Athabasca University. We'll be speaking about a fascinating book today, Amma's Daughters, a Memoir, Athabasca University Press 2018. Meenal, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Dr. Balkaran. It's my pleasure to be here.
Please. I'm Raj. Some students call me Dr. Raj or Dr. Balkaran. I see in print, so please, Raj is fine.
Okay, Raj.
Yeah, sure. So a couple things. Let's get this piece out of the way because I think it's fascinating. Athabasca University. That's a unique university, isn't it?
Yes, it is indeed. So we are Canada's open university, and we have existed for more than 50 years. So Athabasca University is kind of modeled on the British or the UK open university pattern. In the old days, everything was correspondence courses and so on. But in keeping with times, all of our courses and programs are now online. But we have what I'm really proud about in terms of working for Athabasca University is its open mandate. So it is about accessibility for students who are traditionally not able to access higher education. So, to get into any of the courses at Athabasca University, for instance, there are no prerequisites, but the courses that students end up doing are of really high quality, cutting edge, leading kind of research oriented, or rather based on the faculty research profile, these courses are designed. So we have this very interesting setup of really high quality education, but access and openness being the most important mandate that kind of is the thread that joins us all together. So I would invite you to look at, to your listeners as well, to look at the website of Athabasca University and see for yourself. You can do standalone courses or programs with Athabasca University from the pleasure of your and comfort of your homes, wherever you are.
Yeah, I'll certainly include the university link in the podcast notes so folks can check it out. Mm-hmm. And I had intended to take a deeper dive into the institution, not by virtue of, not as a function of the podcast prep. I know enough with the book and yourself, but what intrigued me is I was fairly certain in that it was an online university. It was a remote university. And this is fascinating to me because most of my teaching since 2010, since even before I started the PhD, was continuing studies, lifelong mm-hmm. learners, interested learners. And since 2020, that's exclusively been online. Since 2017, but yes. Especially since 2020, it's all been online. So online continuing studies is where I live. It's yes. It's a fascinating space. And so yes. Could you say a little bit, perhaps, if you would indulge me, say a bit about maybe trends you've noticed either at the academy, online learning, since the pandemic, what are you noticing from your perspective?
It is a very interesting times, both for higher education generally, but also for online education. I'm always a little hesitant to refer to Athabasca University as an online university, because that's a very interesting area and pretty profit motivated. But Athabasca University is actually a public university. And online is just a tool for Athabasca University. The mainstay of Athabasca University is like any research-oriented, we are a comprehensive research-oriented university. So our faculty do teaching and research and service and all of that. And that is what feeds our courses and programs. And like I was mentioning, the open mandate is really important to Athabasca University, its faculty, but also to our students. So in terms of trends, I would say that we've always had, almost 80 to 90% of our students working full-time or part-time. Also interestingly, and again, that trend is probably in keeping with other institutions as well, not just the ones that are open and online, that more women are taking courses compared to men at the tertiary level. And those trends have only have been quite consistent through the pandemic years as well. So we definitely saw quite a significant increase in student enrollment at the beginning of the pandemic, which has kind of plateaued in the last little while because, suddenly in the early days of the pandemic, everybody was going online, whatever that means. But I think what I realized talking to a number of my colleagues at other institutions, that just by taking your lectures onto Zoom or putting your notes online is not equal to online learning, online pedagogy. So that is where I think Athabasca University really excels. And that is where I feel the trend is also going in terms of now increasingly traditional brick and mortar universities also looking at having recognized that this is a strength, having recognized that this is actually a great demand from students to have this kind of flexibility in terms of their geographic location. I am seeing that there is definitely a trend across the board in increasing online offerings. So in terms of Athabasca University, I feel that there is definitely a greater recognition or rather credibility of Athabasca University. It is something as an academic I have noticed. I started my career in a brick and mortar university. And when I, 17 years ago, when I joined Athabasca University, one of the things I did notice was, people kind of would question things like, oh, is that a real university if it's online and that kind of stuff? And that has waned in the last little while because people have, I think my academic colleagues in particular are seeing the value of online pedagogy and online learning because of what we are seeing right now in the world around us. Does that answer your question?
Absolutely. Yeah, the questions are always meant to be generative. but it does, yeah, it's a conversation. And I'm just particularly fascinated in this piece because it's so relevant to my own academic, vocational path. And a couple of the things that really jump out at me is one, uploading videos of one lecturing does not an online course make. I mean, that might make a great YouTube series.
Exactly.
And so one of the things that, initially I was very skeptical personally about online education, but it sort of called to me for reasons that I can't quite figure out. Well, in 2020, I realized I'd been preparing for the pandemic for 3 years, but it being a very old-fashioned sort of, face-to-face, parampara, handshake, a personal connection sort of guy, and then being skeptical about the extent to which that could be translated to the online world, it actually invited me to pioneer for myself ways in which one could do that. And I currently run an online school, which I founded. And part of that is because part of its success is because of a pedagogy that is catered to and appropriate for and effective in via the online medium. Mm-hmm. And in my I can't speak for anyone more than myself, but my personal experience, I was fairly sheepish saying to colleagues. I defended my PhD in 2015. I was a little sheepish saying, oh, I do this, you know, I have these courses on the side that I do, or online courses that I do. And really post 2020, it was like, hey, Raj, you know, how do I take this online? What are some strategies, tools, techniques? So without question, folks understand that the online sphere is not just the gutter or the bargain bin. It's this wild west. It's this space in which you have the fine dining and you have the greasy spoons. You've got the fast food. You have everything in between. Mm-hmm. And folks who, for a variety of reasons, are with it, realize, hey, well, people need to be fed in this online world. Mm-hmm. And if I'm one of the ones called to do that, or if universities are called to innovate, and interestingly enough, I do session of contracts every once in a while, so I can corrupt the youth, you know, at a university. I just finished one at Lethbridge University, and they wanted mm-hmm. someone to teach credited courses online. Yes. And it's two time zones away from where I live. Right. And I suspect that, you know, they wanted a solid scholar. It was to replace Hillary Rodrigues for a year, and he's a great scholar, a great teacher, a great figure. Mm-hmm. But I really suspect why they were quite happy with the choice that they made is because I have experience teaching online and translating this online.
Yeah, it is definitely a different pedagogy, but also distance education is not new. So distance education has existed for a very long time and quite successfully so, right? I mean, in India, I'm sure you're aware of the Indira Gandhi National Open University and South Africa, which is my second home before Canada. We have UNISA, which is the University of South Africa, which is again an open and distance university. And these universities they are both public universities, much like Athabasca University, and they serve a very underserved population. So distance education has a very long pedigree, and online learning is adapting from that. So I think this is where people are beginning to realize, you know, that this pedagogy has existed. The online as a tool is what's new, but distance pedagogy has been evolving for some time now. So I think it is time for us to kind of maybe be a little bit more adventurous because I don't believe we have an option anymore, you know, given the political economy of the world, given the world we live in terms of, you know, economic crisis, climate crisis, mass immigration crisis. There's no dearth of crisis right now. So we do have to think of more innovative ways, more flexible ways to reach out to populations that continue to be underserved.
And yet, while, as of course you're well aware, and as of course you do in your own pedagogy, while ensuring a particular level of rigor, of impact, of knowledge transmission, of that's whatever the transformation is for that particular course.
Yes.
And one can do that and do it online, and in some ways even reach people more deeply because it's on their schedule or it's in a particular setting. Mm-hmm. Enough about online education. I mean, I could probably talk to you for an hour about that. It just happens to be a passion and interest. And
maybe we have to have another session for that.
Yeah. Frankly, it seems to be where I live, online Hindu studies, continuing studies. Amma's Daughters, a memoir. Mm-hmm. This book is unique in a number of ways. Tell us a bit about the vision of the book, and if you care to, the genesis of this book.
Sure. So when I started, I had no vision about this book. It was really, it started as a personal project, a rather emotional project, soon after the demise of my mother. And it was actually a project that she had talked about most of my life. So in 2010, when my mother passed away after a six-year-old battle with cancer, after a, you know, suitable length of grieving, I'm laughing now, but it was a very difficult time for me of grieving the death of my mother, but also feeling like an orphan because my father had already passed on. And also I was living in Canada So I was like, I almost felt homeless, you know, having lost my parents and not living in a place, you know, where I was still kind of building community and building a life. And my husband was living in South Africa at the time. So it was a very intense emotional period for me when my mother passed away. So this was one of, you know, kind of the healing journey that I undertook about a year after my mother had passed away. And it was also connected to a physical healing journey because I had to go for spinal surgery around the same time, soon after my mother's passing. So it was this, you know, like these layers of intensity and layers of trauma that I was dealing with. The only way out of me for at the time was to actually be very, to embark on some sort of a conscious healing journey. And this was part of what I was trying to do at the time. So I just started writing. You know, I like I mentioned, my mother had always mentioned this long-term project of hers. She was a prolific writer. She was a professor of Indian classical music, Hindustani classical music at Rajasthan University. And she had written 8 books, and she had written thousands of classical bandishes, khayal, etc. But this was one book she always talked about, but never put even a word on paper about it. And it was, she used to call it Jaisa Maine Suna Aur Dekha, which translates to what I heard and saw. And what she wanted to do was write a book about her mother and father, who were freedom fighters, and her perception of their life's journey. So as part of my healing journey, I went back to that project and I said, okay, what do I remember? What have I heard and seen? So I started to work on this, you know, writing from this very personal perspective. And then I was very fortunate to chance upon my grandmother's published autobiography and unpublished personal diary. And reading those two things was in the light of what I know now, because I had read both of those when I was much younger, and it was no more than a personal diary, you know, a personal account for me. But now, after, you know, having gained some insights into how history works and engaging with critical questions of both history and political economy, I was suddenly quite aware of the enormity of what was in my hands as historical material. So, and that realization then led me to treat it not just as an emotional project, but it transformed into an intellectual pursuit. So, I spent 7 years working on this book. And after the initial, you know, just the writing bit that I was doing in terms of sketching out the details, I undertook archival research. And I also interviewed whoever I could manage to connect with who had known my grandparents or my mother and her sister in any capacity. So I used kind of archival and interview as methods to authenticate what I had found in those published and unpublished sources, but also in terms of what I had inherited as oral family history, the stories I had heard about my grandparents. So combining all of those, I wrote a few academic articles about archival research and about the role of women in India's independence movement. But most importantly, what came out of that those years of you know, researching and writing was this book, Amma's Daughters. So that is kind of in a nutshell, but not quite a small nutshell, how this started and how it ended, I guess. And also, it was very important for me that this book was published by Athabasca University Press, because it is an open access press. So the electronic version of this book is a free downloadable version. But yes, you can buy a print copy, which is not free, obviously. To me, that was another important aspect of publishing this book. All of those things are kind of a variety of strands that went into making this book. But yeah, I'm so happy to be talking about this.
Yeah, the open access link will also be supplied in the podcast notes, mm-hmm. along with the link whereby folks could purchase a print copy if they're interested. So two questions come to mind. Which one should I ask first? Okay. What was that process like for you? The process, the methodology, if you will, the process whereby you were commingling personal memory, memoirs of a beloved, family memories, historical methods, the tenets of academic inquiry. You know, what was that process like for you?
Yeah, it was actually a very difficult process, I must admit, because it was not just an academic project. It became an academic project, but because it started as a personal project, it added layers to the process that I was not familiar with. I had spent a lifetime learning to write, in a kind of neutral or supposedly neutral way of an academic, you know, dispassionate,
the mythical objective onlooker.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I had spent a lifetime developing how to write that and how to think like that. And here I was suddenly writing on something that I could not be distant from. It was, you know, it was part of who I am. So it was a very difficult there was a lot of learning and unlearning involved when I embarked on this process. And I had no idea what I was doing I probably still am at a loss to put this into any one category. Because yes, it's a nonfiction, it's historical, it's narrative, it's first person, but then I'm not that first person. It's in my mother's voice, because it was very important for me that this remained my mother's story. So it's in her voice, but it is a first person narrative. It is nonfiction, but there are elements in there which were, for instance, there is one character in there, Kamala Masi, who is an amalgam of a few people I knew and about whom I could get more information, but it is not a real person. So there are those kind of elements in there. So, in terms of the literary genre, it's very hard for me to pigeonhole it into any one classification. And at the same time, it's also on the cusp of an academic and personal project. So there are all these ways in which I found that, you know, I'm probably too much wedded to structure, and this was not fitting any structure that I knew well enough. So to me, that was one of the very hard things that I had to navigate, that, you know, what do I call it. But it wasn't something that I was thinking of when I was working on it. These were questions of, when the publication process started. This is when I was asking those questions and falling short in terms of answering those questions by myself. But the Athabasca University editorial team was just fantastic. And they really helped me think through some of those things. And I'm really grateful for how they approached it in a very open-minded way, and weren't really concerned that it doesn't fit into one specific criteria or classification. So that was really great. But going back to the issue of process, like I was mentioning earlier, it kind of started as almost like a narrative outpouring of what I knew, what I remembered, and an avalanche of memories that sometimes I wasn't even sure, you know, sometimes I knew they were not my own. And so, you know, what is this happening? So there were all those kind of issues that were very interesting for me, and especially now when I look back. But at the time, they were quite disorienting, that, you know, this is what a writing process looks like. This is what a creative writing process feels like. I had no idea. So there were all of those kind of very interesting aspects of the process that I have now, I've come to cherish, but at the time they scared me. And then, of course, there's in terms of the process, the most comfortable I was in the process was with the historical research part, because that is something I understand and I can work with. And that's where I felt on kind of solid ground that, oh, okay, now I know what I'm doing. And then the other big piece in terms of the process is the publication process itself. Which was another, this wasn't my first book. I had co-edited another book a little while before that. And I was working with pretty much the same team at Athabasca University Press. So that was very helpful to have gone through that and to kind of know what to expect. So there are all these pieces to writing a book, and I suppose everybody has their own share of, you know, scary moments and uncertainties and disorientation. And I think I had my fair share of all of those.
Yeah, I mean, anyone who's written a book or has a vivid imagination understands, or both in certain cases of some books, they understand that books are birthings. It's labor in all senses, and that there are those in your field, be they interlocutors at home or armchair advisors or actual advisors, and certainly your editorial team, where the best such professionals are but midwives, where they accept that the baby will come the way the baby will come, but there are particular safeguards in place to receive it in a healthy manner and name it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Okay, enough analogies for one day, for now. How is the book structured? Speaking of which, how did you end up structuring the book?
It was quite organic, because I essentially, and again, this was mainly because I like structure. I kept it very chronological, because what
an academic who likes structure. I know not what you mean. I number my interviews just because. Sorry, go on.
Excuse me. No, exactly. Right. I mean, I think this is again, one of the ways you kind of learn as an academic, how to manage, you know, this incredible amount of data or literature that that you encounter and you have to process. So I think that's what teaches academics to respect, if not love, structure. But in my case, maybe it's maybe combined with my personality as well, which is, I'm unfortunately a little bit embarrassed to admit that, yes, structure gives me a sense of security, I guess. So in keeping with that, there was no other way for me to write this book, at least this one, other than keeping it chronological. And there was another reason why that actually worked, because what I inherited in terms of the autobiography and my grandmother's diary, there was no structure. There was no chronological thread that was kept consistent. Because essentially how my grandmother wrote her diaries was a very interesting process. This was a young woman on the move all the time, but she was also very committed to writing a daily journal. And she used to write very thoughtful, long journals. But because she was constantly moving, she had all these notebooks, and she would pick up the one that was closest to her and start writing. But what that meant was that sometimes the only surviving diary that we have of hers, so the first entry is from 1923, and then it, I'm sorry, it's 1926, and then the next entry maybe 1930, another one will be, the one after that will be, you know, consecutive for a little while, and then it would be somewhere 1960. And then again, 1940, because she was picking up these books and would start writing, not even necessarily at, you know, the next page, but wherever the book opens, she would start writing. This was a woman who was in a big hurry and had a lot of responsibility. So that's what I inherited. So there was like this jumble of materials that I had in her personal diary. And she, her published autobiography is pretty much the same. There again, you know, one story doesn't necessarily follow the other story in any kind of chronological order. So this was one of the ways in which I was trying to untangle this jumble of of events and dates and names and places that I had in front of me. So the structure of the book is consequently totally chronological.
I chuckled to myself. Thank goodness I mute for most of these podcasts. I chuckled to myself because two things come to mind. One is, my goodness, you must be able to relate to someone who studies the Puranas, where there's a tale here, a tale there, a dynasty here, a teaching there, Shastric stuff here, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. And there's this patchwork. And then it's my job as the scholar or the mythologist or the incarnate Pauranika or whatever, however you want to view my job, to make sense, because there is great meaning and sense in there.
Yes.
Although prima facie it may not appear so.
Yes.
But without question, there's profound meaning within the folds of the corpus, without question. Mm-hmm. The other thing that comes to mind as you were speaking is that one of the things I love about the writing style you describe is that the person is not writing for posterity. The person mm-hmm. is not writing for the audience. This is not performance. She's relishing the experience of writing as a means of making sense of her life. And it's something as if this is a vitamin that I'm going to be stronger if I get in today, wherever I can down the vitamin C or whatever it is. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, obviously you'd have a better sense, but this indicates to me somebody who's writing for themselves mm-hmm. and their process, which while makes it less organized, probably makes it more rich.
You're absolutely right. I think she was certainly writing for herself, that is my grandmother. But at the same time, I feel somewhere deep down, she did have a sense of history of the times she was living in. So partly, she was also chronicling something that she understood was historical times. I don't think she was very aware of her own role in that broader history, but she certainly was aware of it being a kind of a turning point, a historical turning point. And I'd like to believe that to an extent, she was writing so that her story would be known. So yes, she wasn't writing for an audience, but she was writing because she wanted these stories to be known. And they are momentous stories, you know, for someone who passed away when she was only 54 years old, her life was so eventful, and there were so many significant events that were connected to the larger historical movement. She does not, her writing doesn't betray that she understood her own place in those momentous events. But at the same time, there is that recognition that something really momentous was happening. But also as a woman in those times, she could see that she was breaking new paths. And I think that is why she wanted those stories. She understood the significance of those stories for the next generation. So she actually kept these diaries hidden. She didn't like her daughters reading these diaries. It was always a thing of my mother used to tell us that she would read these diaries secretly because her mother didn't like that the daughter should read it now, but she was keeping all of them because if she didn't want those stories to be read, she had many opportunities to destroy those diaries, but she didn't. She kept them all, but she... So yeah, so there it's a bit of a mixed bag in some ways. It's a mixture of a variety of things that were going on there. But also it was a very interesting time of upheaval, in the country, but also in for a person, for the individual individuals who were part of these stories. So yeah, you're right, but it just makes it, not that lack of clarity about that their place in history on one hand makes for these kind of non-chronological and pieces that are spread everywhere, but at the same time, like you mentioned, that's what makes it really rich, because it's coming not with an intention of telling a story a certain way, but it's just put out there for anyone to read and interpret it in their own way.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
She's channeling experience through the written word. She's channeling, weaving fabric, and however they've tailored beyond her time is up to posterity, but she's just generating fabric.
Yes. That's a good analogy. I like that.
What was the times in which she lived, and what do you mean when you say she didn't realize her participation or her impact on those times? Say more about that. And otherwise, put, you could even tell us, you know, what's the book about?
I can probably answer both of them at the same time. So the book is about a 12-year-old girl who was imprisoned for treason and sedition in 1930. So she came from a very privileged family, but because of a personal trauma, she joined the Indian National Movement at a very young age. And like I mentioned, at 12 years of age, she was imprisoned, and she was in and out of jail for three times before she turned 16 years of age. So she wrote detailed accounts of her prison sentencing, how it happened, and her experiences of being in prison, the violence she endured. In her autobiography, it's mostly about her involvement in the freedom movement. Her autobiography came out in 1962. So of course it was after independence. So there she's kind of reading it from the, or writing it from the perspective of what has happened. And of course she understands her place in history, but she was never the central figure in any of her stories, except the stories of her being in jail, where she's talking about her personal experience. But in most of her stories, she's talking about, the broader picture. So the bigger picture of these massive protest marches that were happening and the violence that was committed by the state through the use of police and militia on these unarmed protesters. So she's talking about those things, but there she is. She's a very young woman in the 1930s. She is a direct witness of all of that. So she does mention where she is and what's happening to her. But like I said, she never puts herself in the middle of it. She's not the focus of any of those stories. So that was the one part of her story that came from her autobiography. And then she also spoke about her experience of being one of the first women bureaucrats in independent India. She was a deputy director of the social welfare department in UP at the time. I think it was United Province. So she spoke about her, or she wrote about her experience of doing that by being virtually a single parent, and how that looked from her perspective. But again, without any commentary, there was no analysis of why this is happening to her, or even any complaint about why this is happening to her. But it was mostly in terms of, okay, this is what I went through, this is how I managed, and these were the people who helped me, and these were my experiences, some of which were really incredible experiences, like including one where she was escorted by dacoits across a ravine and so on. So like incredible stories, but she tells them really very nonchalantly. You know, for her, it was just, this is how I live my life. So that's what I mean when I say that, you know, she doesn't display any sense of her her place in history in some ways. But going back to the book, what the book is about, yes, it has all of those stories about this young woman who then, after serving three jail terms, when she was about 16 years old, after her third jail term, she was not too old to be out in the world, unmarried, and without the protection of her family name, because she chose not to use her surname. She chose not to go back home. So here is this single woman in 1936 who is still part of the freedom movement and now facing opposition from the freedom movement, because there were her own comrades who were questioning her credibility. They were questioning her character. And you know, there was this pushback that this single woman, unattached single woman, was something to be tamed or was fair game. And so there were all those other obstacles that suddenly arose in her way after she got out of jail. So prison wasn't hard enough. Now she had this whole new set of problems that she had to encounter. And so those were the things I got from her diaries, more than her autobiography. And of course, my mother's stories, my mother and my aunt were custodians of many of those stories. So the story is told from my mother's perspective, because like I said, it is in her voice because it honors her, but it's also it's my way of acknowledging the fact that almost all of those stories I had heard from my mother before they were committed to paper. But between that and between hearing those stories and writing them, there was this long series of authentication that happened, either through interviews, through archival research, and so on. So in this book, the story unfolds through the eyes of a very young Surekha, that's my mother, and how she gradually learns about this very interesting past of her mysterious and very unconventional parents, because both her parents were freedom fighters. But in this book, Amma's daughters, Amma is the central character. I had to actually quite consciously keep my grandfather out of it, because he was larger than life. He was in every way possible. He was a former bodybuilder. He was a close associate of Subhash Chandra Bose. He spoke so many different languages. He spoke Bangla, Marathi, Odia, Hindi, of course, Hindi, English, Sanskrit, etc. He was a polyglot, but he also spoke French and German, and I don't know what else. So we had this library full of books in so many languages because of my grandfather. And he was this he had a bombastic voice, and he was an amazing singer. So you had this, and I knew him. This was the other thing, because I was only, I was a baby when my grandmother passed away. So I don't remember my grandmother. I lived in her shadow because her stories were always around me. But my grandfather lived to be more than 90 years old. He only passed away in 1990. So, I remember him really vividly. So for me, my grandfather was a lot more real than my grandmother in some ways. So I had to really work on it. And also the part of, because the book kind of stops at the death of my grandmother. So it couldn't be about how I saw my grandfather. It had to be about how he was as a father and a husband, and not as a grandfather. Because as a grandfather, he was this incredibly doting, wonderfully loving a grandfather who also taught us a lot of things. He introduced us to all kinds of stories from the Vedas and Puranas, and taught us mantras. And he was this incredibly loving grandfather. But as a father, he was an absentee father. He was hardly there for my mother or her sister. And as a husband, he was borderline cruel. So, I had to really work on accommodating those various perspectives or facets of this one person. So yes, I think you asked me to tell you what the book is in a nutshell, but Obviously, I'm using really large nutshells to give you these answers, but basically, this book is in a nutshell. If I were to try to tell you in a nutshell, it can be seen as a story of two women who grew up in the shadow of these two very unconventional former freedom fighters of in the War of Independence, or rather Indian independence movement. But it's also the story of the important role that women have played in historical movements and moments, and that we continue to, even in the 21st century, they continue to be invisible to us.
Yeah, there are no nutshells and responses, and my questions are purposefully provocative in the sense of provoking dialogue, expansion, mm-hmm. reflection. This is what I see to be my dharma, both as a podcast host and at times as an online teacher, but that's a story for another day. So do you maybe want to share a little snippet of the book for us?
Sure.
Give folks the flavor of the text.
I would love to do that. So there is this, it's right in the beginning of the book. What is this? Chapter 3. So not quite the beginning. In this passage, Amma is opening up to her daughters for the first time and describing in her own words what it was like to participate in the civil disobedience movement. And most of this passage I've used, of course, both her autobiography and her personal diary to fill in the details in this passage. So this starts from page 98. Amma described the phenomenon of women courting arrest in large numbers in response to Gandhiji's call for mass civil disobedience in 1930. Hundreds of thousands of women stepped out of their homes, defying their families and ancient customs, as well as British law. Women joined picket lines, protest rallies, and Prabhat Feri marches at daybreak through the streets of cities and towns, singing spiritual songs, infused with nationalist fervor. Veiled women made salt on their terraces and in their courtyards, literally shouting from rooftops that they had broken the law. This dramatic influx of women into the civil disobedience movement posed a logistical problem for the British, whose prisons were not equipped to take in so many women detainees. Hoping to cut to the heart of the problem, the British sent undercover informants into public meetings to identify women who appeared to be ringleaders. Young Shanti's every step was shadowed by the police, and her rousing public speeches were duly noted. After she was arrested early in the fall of 1930, she was sentenced to 6 months in prison. With a wry smile, Amma recalled how the magistrate who sentenced her seemed reluctant to do so. She was barely more than a child. She also fondly remembered the affection showed to her as the youngest inmate by the other political prisoners, as well as the stream of visitors who came to bless her and be blessed by her. This flow of visitors had not ebbed when the British authorities decided to transfer Amma from Ajmer to the Lucknow jail. She was also touched by the generosity of Kamala Nehru here. The prison guards were noticeably lenient towards the handful of women prisoners who had family connections, and Nehruji's wife had been permitted to arrange for the delivery of home-cooked hot meals. These she insisted on sharing with Shanti, moved by the girl's young age and her lack of family. Most importantly, Shanti witnessed the courage of the many women prisoners who participated in daily meetings and every morning and evening joined their voices for an hour in the singing of nationalist songs. The vast majority of these prisoners had no privileged status. They were often from ordinary middle-class families, women with little by way of education who had been arrested for doing what they believed to be right. Many of them especially those who had small children, were worried about their future after prison. To turn those fears to their advantage, the British authorities offered a pardon to any woman who would apologize for participating in seditious activities and swear an oath to never do so again. Yet, despite the tempting prospect of official forgiveness and a swift release, Amma could not recall a single woman who accepted this offer.
Fascinating. Thank you for sharing that vignette.
Thank you.
Let's see. You know, we're coming fairly close to time today. What I want to ask, well, let me ask you this before I ask a couple of my last questions. Was there anything about the book that you hoped we touched on today? Is there anything in particular that you wanted us to touch on?
I love the questions you asked, and I think they got me really talking. But I sometimes do lose.
You were in the flow. Okay, great.
So let me just say if there's anything that's missing.
Yeah. Sure. Well, that means there was nothing top of mind. There was no particular agenda coming in. So I understand. No. So yeah. Let me ask you this. Who might most benefit from this book? Whether in terms of interests, subfields, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Who might this book most be for?
Thank you. That's another great question, I would say. And I think how I look at this book is it's based out of India. Yes, the context is the Indian National Movement. But a lot of the issues that are raised in the book are still very relevant. Yes, you can say that this all happened almost 100 years ago, but we seem to be fighting, especially as women anywhere in the world, not just Indian women, but women everywhere seem to be still fighting the same battles over and over again. So for me, that's the one thing that I would like to say about this book. Writing this book gave me an appreciation, because I've often heard, people talk about, especially, a lot of women's rights advocates and feminists would tell you that women are fighting the same battle every generation. But when I started working on this book, I realized how true it was. And it didn't matter what the context was. It didn't matter. Your geographical and cultural context did not matter. This is an ongoing battle. It's a necessary battle. But if we read and if we learn from each other, then we are likely to organize better. We are likely to understand these situations better. And hopefully we are likely to create more alliances. So in terms of who this book could speak to, I would say that anyone who's concerned about social justice, women or non-women, men, women, children, whoever, and it is, I believe, an important duty for all of us to be thinking in terms of, justice and inclusivity and sustainability. We are living in an era of climate crisis, along with a lot of other crises that I mentioned earlier. So, I do think that it's not something that, that should be a responsibility of thought leaders or intellectuals or politicians or government officials. It should be something that we should all take ownership of, that we do need to work towards a more inclusive and just and fair and sustainable world. And if you are concerned with those things, then it really helps to broaden your horizon, to see what has happened before and to see how people have resisted and survived and thrived despite all the odds. So I hope this book will speak to people who are concerned about justice and change and resilience. You don't have to be a woman to read this book, and you definitely don't have to be just Indian to read this book.
I can vouch for one of those. an enjoyable read is an enjoyable read, and there's so much that comes to mind reading this. On the one hand, the more things change, the more they stay the same, and certain struggles are as vivid and palpable now as ever, and yet Without question, we've made phenomenal progress in a short century.
We have. Exactly.
And yet at the same time, with the ebb and flow, sometimes the lows are so low, it feels yes. like we're back in chains or back yes. into being property or back, et cetera, et cetera, et
yes.
cetera.
Absolutely.
And yet,
but it also gives you hope in terms of, and this is why I think it's important to read about other people's lives to see how far we have come. Yes, we are fighting the same battles, but at the same time, we are not starting from zero. We are standing on the shoulders of giants. So this is another important reminder for us that, you know, it's not all hopeless. But yes, we have gone through this process over and over again, but we can always start from strength. And that's where we are. We are in a position of strength. We just have to learn to, if we are aware of that foundation, then we can build a bigger building, a more inclusive building. But if we don't pay attention to what has happened before, then that is when we feel lost and hopeless.
My final question for today is, why is the book called Amma's Daughters? Who are Amma's Daughters and what's the relevance of that phrase?
So the title of the book came to me right in the beginning when I started writing this. It was actually Amma's daughter because I was writing from my mother's perspective. And so the logical title that came to me was Amma's daughter. And then as I was writing more, I was like, oh, but Amma had two daughters. So, you know, I thought, yeah, it can't be daughter. It has to be daughters, you know, because it was my Masi and my mother, Amma's two daughters. But then as I started doing the archival research and discovered these erased women from Indian national movement's history, the daughters for me took on a totally different meaning. And it wasn't just Amma's daughters by blood, but also Amma's daughters who were connected by act and deed and location and time and space and all of that. So, you know, the daughters for me, doesn't just denote her family, but it denotes all of Amma's daughters who are everywhere in the world.
Lovely. Thank you very much for appearing on the podcast today.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. I really enjoyed talking to you.
For those of you listening, we, of course, have been speaking with Dr. Meenal Srivastava of Athabasca University about her new Athabasca University Press publication, Amma's Daughters, a memoir. Until next time, keep the same, stay grounded, and keep contemplating the impact of powerful women in this world. Take care.